Well, welcome to Math 428. This is a class on Fourier analysis. This is a beautiful subject. Let's see, I've got a web page for this class. The URL is www.math.purdue.edu/bell, B-E-L-L, / MA 428. So I'll be posting the homework assignments there and lots of information. There's my office hours. There's the name of our grader who'll be grading the homework, and there's the name of the textbook, which is this book, Fourier Analysis by Eli Stein and Shakarchi from the Princeton Lecture Series in Math. It's a fantastic book. Eli Stein is a famous and brilliant mathematician. So it's this blue book. It's volume one of a four-volume series and analysis from the Princeton series. And I'm kind of connected to Eli Stein because my advisor, while I was a PhD student at MIT, my advisor was writing a book with Stein, which I got to proofread. So I feel connected to him. And I think my advisor learned a lot of this material from Stein, so it's kind of a direct line to... Anyway, I think you'll find it's a fantastic book, and you should start reading it. Start reading the introduction in chapter one right away. And I'll give you sort of more exact page numbers as we go. Let's see, that's I'm going to be writing on a tablet PC, I hope, if it works properly. And you'll notice here, it's aftermath. After my lectures, I'm going to post the remains of my lecture notes on in the aftermath there. So it's not there yet, but after today, I'll put this stuff that I write there. So if you ever have to miss a class, you'll find what I did pretty easily. Questions about anything right off the bat? Yeah.
That's all. Homework assignment's going to come from the textbook.
Yes, it'll be homework assignments from the textbook. I'll start putting those out on Wednesday. I figure I wouldn't do it the first day of class. So the first assignment is to start reading the book. Others, questions? Well, I thought I would introduce Fourier series kind of gently and historically, because it's a beautiful subject and it has a great long history. You know, and you've learned various kinds of series and how to expand functions in series, like power series. Those are beautiful series. And so things like sine of x and e to the x have expansions in power series. Let's see, 1 plus x squared over 2 factorial plus x cubed over 3 factorial, etc. And you probably studied power series in your basic analysis classes. And those coefficients are given by Taylor's formula. The nth coefficient would be the nth derivative at 0 divided by n factorial. Well, the object of study in this course are Fourier series, and they're totally different. They look like this. You want to expand a function in terms of basic trigonometric functions. That's the big idea. So you want to say f of x is a constant, maybe, and then we'd have a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity of wiggling sine and cosine functions. So a n sine n of x, n times x, plus b n times cosine nx. And in fact, we want to expand any function you give me. I want to expand like that. And it's hard to imagine that would be possible. So let's say that f was, you know, linear in places. Those sines and cosines wiggle like hell. The bigger n gets, the more they wiggle. So I want to add up things that wiggle faster and faster and make them add up to something that's not wiggling, perhaps. And so right off the bat, it seems like that's an impossible task, but it turns out to be possible for... And the reasons are kind of beautiful and fascinating. So that's what Fourier series are. The coefficients in Fourier series are going to depend on integrals. So unlike the power series, which depend on derivatives, the ans and bns in Fourier series are going to depend on integrals. Meaning, yeah. So I thought a good way to introduce the subject, maybe the best way, is by historical reasons why they came up. Of course, they're named after Fourier, and Fourier did use them when he studied heat. But it turns out that Johann Bernoulli stumbled across them at an earlier time. So this is an interesting story of Bernoulli versus Bernoulli. Let's see, Bernoulli versus Bernoulli. So the story is that there was the big daddy Bernoulli, Jakob Bernoulli, and he had two sons, Johann and Jakob, Jakob Jr. And the two sons were very competitive. And I'm sure that Johann Bernoulli figured out how to do this problem. I'm going to talk about the vibrating string problem. I'm sure Johann Bernoulli figured out how to do it and then challenged his brother to do it also. And so the old man, Jakob Sr., was going to judge the two of them and see which one came up with the best answer. And the funny thing is, they both came up with fantastic answers. But Johann Bernoulli's solution to the problem is he invented Fourier series to solve it. And so let me show you what the problem is. I'm going to call this the harpsichord problem. So let's see, to describe it, I'm going to have a string stretched from, let's make the string of length pi just to make life easier. So I've got a string stretched from 0 to pi, and it's when you pluck it, it's going to move and vibrate. It's being held down at the ends because it's a harpsichord string. And let's see, to describe the motion here, at a spot x here, I'll consider that little distance, and I'll call that little distance u of x. It depends on x, and that's going to change with time. So that's u of xt. Right in that picture there, that u of xt is positive. But when the thing bumps below the axis there, then the u would be negative. So it can be negative. If you do Newton's laws of motion for a little chunk of that string, make it a little delta x piece of the string and do Newton's F equals ma, you can mess around and find out that that function u of xt satisfies the wave equation, which is it's going to be d2u dt squared, that's partial derivatives with respect to t, equals c squared, c is a constant that depends on the string, d2u dx squared. C also turns out to be the speed of propagation of waves, how fast they travel. So that's why it's traditional to call that c squared there. In the end, c is going to be the speed of propagation. So if I hit it with a stick, the wave would travel at speed c. If this was electromagnetic radiation, c would be the speed of light. But here it's just the speed of a wave on the string. To make my life easier, though, today, I'm going to assume that the c is equal to 1. Just to make less writing to do. That's the problem. That's the differential equation that Newton's laws F equal ma give you. But let's see, it's a partial differential equation, so you haven't probably run into one of those yet, or certainly haven't solved one yet. And so Johann came up with some sneaky, clever ways to deal with that problem. Let's see, if you think about a string, though, I'm showing you sort of where it is in the middle. If this is a real harpsichord, I would have to do something to the string to make it move. So it's going to be critical to say how you start the string. On a harp, I like harpsichords because they're plucked. So on a harpsichord, let's take the string to start like this. This is called an initial condition. So I'll pluck it from the middle just to make my life easier. So I'll hold it by a spot on the string. It's actually a little quill in a harpsichord. And I'll pull it up, and from rest, I'll let go. So that's the initial condition. Of a plucked harpsichord. And so the initial condition would be U of X at time 0 is equal to this shape. Little teepee shape thing. Let's call that a function f of x. There's actually a secret initial condition that I'm not mentioning. Well, I'm going to mention it now. If this was a piano, I'd hit it with a hammer. And that would cause it to deform, and it would also give it an initial velocity. So it turns out the fact that I'm dropping this thing from rest is also important. So an initial condition in the background. So I would call this initial condition number 2. The thing starts from rest. Which means that, that would mean the change with respect to time at time 0 is 0. So that would mean d by dt at any point x at time 0 is nothing. It's not moving. Okay, so that's an initial condition that I'll also need. Well, Jacob Bernoulli had this brilliant idea, which gave a very beautiful solution. So Jacob came up with a solution that was U of XT. He was able to show that it's a composition of two traveling waves. One of those waves moves to the left to right, and the other moves right to left. And he figured out a clever way to get these two waves to add up and solve the problem, and to solve the initial condition. And Jacob actually won the contest, because his solution was, he could demonstrate that his solution was right. And he won the prize. Johann's solution was brilliant, but he had more trouble convincing dear old dad that it was right. So Johann got the idea to solve this partial differential equation. Let's try to look for solutions of a special form. And the special form was U of xt is a function of x times a function of time. By the way, this is called D'Alembert's solution to the wave equation. I'm going to demonstrate this solution later on. But for now, we won't pay any attention to Jacob. We're going to fixate on Johann. So Johann's big idea was, okay, first let's look for special solutions of this special form. A function of x times a function of time. Not every function can be written like that. Like e to the x times y. It's not such a thing. So not every function can be written like that. So this is pretty desperate of Johann. And so we're going to try to find solutions that look like this. So step one is to stick them into that partial differential equation and see what happens. So I want to plug them in and make them work. So I want d by dt squared of x times t of t to be equal to d by dx squared of x times t of t. When I differentiate those things, let's see, the x of x acts like a constant there. And so the t derivatives just pile onto t, and that thing just acts like a constant. So that would give me x of x. And the t derivatives would be ordinary derivatives. T times t double prime of t. And I want that to be equal to, let's see what I do, the same thing here. The x derivatives would pile on the x function. And the t of t would look like a constant, and so it would just float along. That's what I need to happen for it to solve the differential equation. Well, you look at that for a second and try to figure out what to do. One obvious thing to try is to pull all the x functions to one side. And all the t functions to the other side. And then stare at that for a while. Ask yourself how it would be possible to have a function of x be equal to a function of a totally different variable time. Anybody seen this before? Yeah. They have to be constants. The only way that kind of equation could hold is if those things are both equal to a constant. And so if you think about it, what if I stuck in x equals 0? Then I'd have a constant on the left, and then I'd let the t change. That would show me that function on the right is a constant. And similarly, I could stick in time equal 10 minutes, put it in there to get a constant, and then let the x move around, and that would show me the left-hand side is the same constant. So this can only happen . This must equal a constant lambda. Let's call it lambda. If I was going to write out how to see that, let x equal about pi over 2. Let t vary. That shows you that it's that the t thing is a constant, and then let t equal a constant. Something, who cares what? 1 minute. And let x vary. Then you'd see that thing is constant also in x. Okay, so that's exciting, because now, when I use that fact, those are going to be ordinary differential equations. And so, I get two ODEs. Let's see, this one, one of them is x double prime minus lambda x equals 0, and the t one's the same. T double prime minus lambda t equals 0. It turns out the t one is the one is going to be the easy one. The x one is going to be problematic. It's going to be a more interesting problem. So what I'm going to do is going to save the t one for last, the t problem for last. Let's think about what I have to do to make the x problem hold. There was something I kind of neglected in the beginning. I told you what the initial conditions were. Let me scroll back, way back. I told you what the initial conditions were, but there's also something called a boundary condition. This is a harpsichord, and so these strings are pinned down at the ends. The ends aren't going to move. So that means that u at 0 for all time is just pinned there. It's not moving. And u at pi for all time is pinned there. So I told you the initial condition is the shape of a pluck, but there's also something called the boundary conditions. And that's what I'm going to have to worry about next. I found how to find a solution, but now I've got to sweat about the boundary conditions. Because the thing is pinned down at the endpoints, I have that u at x equals 0 for all time is pinned down, and u at x equals pi for all time is pinned down. And so I'm going to start looking for solutions to the PDE that also satisfy those boundary conditions. Let's think about it. So, let's see, you, at time, remember u of xt is x of x times t of t. So boundary condition one is that u at x equals zero for all time, that would be x of zero times t of t. And I want that to be equal to zero. Well, if you think about that for a minute, there's two ways to make that zero. I could either make x of zero be zero, or I could make t of t be zero for all time. That would give me the zero solution. If I made t of t zero for all time, that would give me the zero solution. And I know the string just sitting there is a solution. I know a string can do that. So that's the dumb solution. So I don't want t of t to be zero for all time, because that would just give me the zero solution. We don't want t of t identically zero. That would be the zero solution. The string just sits there and doesn't do anything. So that means I better have x of zero be equal to zero. So I need, that's another boundary, that's a new kind of boundary condition. I need x of zero equals zero. That's going to be important. Similarly for the other boundary condition, at pi end, that would be x of pi times t of t. And once again, I don't want t of t equal to zero. And so I better have x of pi equal to zero. And that leads to a very famous problem. I've got an ODE with, this looks like an initial condition, like at x equals zero. That feels like an initial condition. But if zero is initial, then what the heck is pi? This is a new kind of condition. These are called boundary conditions. It's at the left and right endpoints of the string. So they're not like initial conditions like you learned in an ODE class. They're something called boundary conditions. And so this, in fact, is a famous kind of boundary problem. This is called a Sturm-Liouville problem. It's the very first one. And so let's see, the differential equation is x double prime minus lambda x equals zero. Subject to the boundary conditions, x of zero equals zero, and x of pi equals zero. Those are called boundary conditions. And that's why I'm fixating on the x problem rather than the t problem. The t problem has no such restrictions. And it turns out that this is going to tell me very specific lambda possibilities. I can't just have any old lambda. To make something, to get actually a solution that does this, these conditions require lambda to be very special. In fact, this is where trig functions come up. I need these functions to wiggle so that they can be zero at zero and wiggle around and come back and be zero at pi. So that, I'm going to have to make a lambda that's going to allow for wiggling. And that's going to give me trig functions. And that's where Fourier series come from. Okay. So let's try to solve this this problem. This ODE is a famous one. It's a second order constant coefficient differential equation. Second order constant coefficient linear ODE. The kind you learn how to study, solve someplace, probably 366 or 262, or an ODE class. And so you remember the thing to do. I'll review quickly how you solve this problem. Remember, you would try x equals e to the rx. And that, when you plug it in, let's see, the second derivative of that would be r squared e to the rx minus lambda e to the rx equals 0. When you plug that in and try to make it work, and I can factor out an e to the rx, and I get this thing which is called the characteristic equation, r squared minus lambda equals 0. And so this is the characteristic polynomial. R squared minus lambda equals 0 is called the characteristic equation for that second order ODE. And so there's going to be cases to consider. So let's do the case lambda equals 0. The solutions look totally different depending on whether or not lambda is 0, positive, or negative. Let's do the case lambda equals 0 first. Case lambda equals 0. In that case, the differential equation is just x double prime equals 0. And so that means the derivative of x prime is equal to 0. That means that x prime is a constant. And if x prime is a constant, then I can integrate that one time and see that x of x would be c1 times x plus c2, just by straight integration. So I integrate twice and I get that. So x of x is a linear thing. And if you think about trying to make those boundary conditions hold, I need x of 0 to be 0 and x of pi to be equal to 0. And this thing is a linear thing. Well, there's only one linear thing that goes through those two. That one sure doesn't. The only linear thing that goes through those two things is this horizontal line 0. So the boundary conditions demand that the thing be the zero line. And so, oops, I get the zero solution. That's a bummer. I didn't get anything out of this one. So, oops, I get the zero solution. So I get zip. Johann must have been panicking at this point. And maybe even more so when I do the case lambda positive. Let's do the case lambda positive. It's convenient to write lambda equals something squared. Let's write lambda equals something squared. Then my characteristic polynomial was r squared minus lambda equals 0. So that would be r squared minus k squared equals 0. And so r would be equal to plus or minus k. And remember, I was trying e to the rx as solutions for that second order equation. So I get x of x equals c1 e to the kx plus c2 e to the minus kx. Those do not wiggle around very good. So I might be able to get the zero, it should be 0 at 0, but exponentials don't wiggle. And in fact, I'm going to show you they don't wiggle. If I get x of 0 equals 0, it doesn't wiggle and it won't come back down and be 0 at pi. And so these are going to also bomb out. So let's see why I can't make them wiggle. Let's see. So I want the boundary conditions. X of 0, let's see, that would be c1 e to the 0 plus c2, that's 1, plus c2 e to the 0. I want that to equal to 0. And that means I need C1 is equal to minus C2. So this is going to tell me C1 plus C2 equals 0. This is going to tell me that C2 has to be minus C1. So now I have x of x is C1 times e to the kx minus e to the minus kx. Let's see, I'll give my, that's a famous function. That, I wish I had a 2, I wish this was over 2. So I'll give myself an over 2 there, and I'll multiply by 2 in the front. That's the arc, what is that? That's the hyperbolic sine function. So that's equal to 2C1 times the hyperbolic sine of kx. And the hyperbolic sine function has a graph that looks like this. Let's see, what does it look like? That's the hyperbolic sine function. So, in particular, if I stuck in pi there, that's not equal to 0. The hyperbolic sine, it's 0 at 0, but it's not 0 at pi. So, the ouch here, the hyperbolic sine of k times pi is not equal to 0. Which means if I'm going to make this equal to 0, I've got to have C1 to be equal to 0. So I must have C1 equal to 0 to make x of pi equal to 0. So once again, I'm forced into getting the 0 solution. So that's a bummer. And now Johann is really panicking. So once again, I get only the 0 solution. Okay, so but now the next one is where the action is going to happen. Let's do the case lambda negative. Case lambda equal negative. So then I would write lambda, let's write lambda is minus k squared, just to make life less writing. Otherwise, I'd be having to write square root of minus lambda, which is no fun. So let's write lambda equal minus something squared, so it's negative. And then my characteristic equation is r squared minus lambda equals 0, and that would become r squared plus k squared equals 0. And let's see, so what does that give me? That gives me complex pure imaginary roots. R equals plus or minus ki. And so now you've got to remember what your ODE facts are. I think I will review ODEs a little bit maybe after we do this, just so it's good and fresh in your minds. But this is the case where you get... you'd get something like, here's one, a complex solution, e to the kix. Which is cosine kx plus I sine kx. And remember, that turns out to be a complex solution. And it's a fact that when you have one complex solution, you get two real solutions. If I were to plug that into the differential equation and split it into real and imaginary parts, I would be able to show you that the real part is a solution and the imaginary part is a solution. And so once you have those, forget you ever saw any complex solution and just use them. So these, from one complex solution, you get two real solutions. So this is a little bit of a review of Math 366. And so once I have two real solutions, all I'd have to do is to demonstrate that I could solve any initial value problem with them. Then I would have the general solution. And that would be checking that the Wronskian of that thing, those two solutions, is non-zero. That would show me I have a complete set of solutions, and I can solve any initial value problem. So I'd get all possible solutions that way. That's the theory of ODEs. But today I'm just reviewing very quickly this fact. The general solution to that equation is x of x equals c1 cosine kx plus c2 sine kx. Those wiggle, so now it's hopeful. Hopeful that I can have it be 0 at 0, wiggle around a little bit, and come back and be 0 at pi. Let's see what we can do, what that does to us. So I need x at 0, let's see, that would be c1 times cosine of 0, which is 1, plus c2 times the sine of 0, which is 0. So that would be equal to c1, and I want that to equal 0. Oops, so I'm getting c1 equals 0 there. Johann must have really been getting scared. So I got to have C1 be 0. So now I know that x of x is just C2 sine kx. And now I've got to stick in pi and see and make it 0. So finally, the last step where I'm actually going to get something, I also need x of pi. I don't want C2 to be 0. That would mean, once again, I get the 0 solution. So I want that to equal to 0. And so I don't want C2 to be 0, because otherwise I'd get the solution, the 0 solution. I don't want C2 to be 0, because then I just get the 0 solution again. And that'd be a bummer. So it means I have to have sine k pi equal to 0. And if you think about where does sine, let's see, where's the, let me graph the sine function. So I need sine of k pi equal to 0. Think about the sine function. It wiggles like this. Zero. First zero is at pi, second zero is at 2 pi, third zero is at 3 pi, etc. So here's pi, 2 pi, 3 pi. If sine of k pi is going to be equal to 0, it means that k pi has to be an n pi. Has to be one of those multiples of pi. So this is a graph of sine of x. And the zeros happen at multiples of pi. Zeros at n pi. N equals 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And so that shows me that we must have k pi has to be a multiple of pi. So in other words, k has to be an integer. K is positive. And so the 0, 1 doesn't count. The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. count. So we need n equal 1, 2, 3, etc. And so we find that only very specific values of k are going to give me an interesting solution. We get k must be 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. K equals 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. And remember, my lambda then is minus k squared. So I can't just have any old lambda. Lambda is equal to minus k squared equals minus n squared as n goes from 1, 2, 3, etc. Okay, now the fun starts. Johan must have been getting excited because he finally got some solutions. So this is my x problem solution, and now I'm going to worry about the t problem. So back to the t problem. Remember, the t problem was actually the same as the x problem, but it didn't have any boundary conditions. So the t problem was t double prime minus lambda t equals 0. And now I've got the lambdas equal to minus k n squared. And so the t problem has solutions t of t are, what did I call it? A1 cosine nt plus b1, how about an? Oops, sorry. What the heck? An sine nt. They're wiggling. And so we're starting to feel like we might get vibrations. Let's call this for lambda equals n. Actually, what is it? Lambda is going to be minus n squared. I'm going to get an answer. Un of xt is going to be the x that I found times the t that I found. I'll call them t because they're going to depend. I'm going to call them sub n, because they depend on the n's now. And my x of n was a constant times sine n of x. And now my t function that I just found is a constant times cosine nx, a t rather, plus a constant times sine nt. And let's see, I want to make sure I end in a rip-snorting manner. I think I will. I claim that this C, whatever it is, we can absorb it into these other things. So I can assume that that C is equal to 1. I would absorb it into the A and the B. I can absorb it into the other constants. And now, Johan, that's a solution. I got a bunch of solutions for all different n's. The great idea now is add them up. I have got, these all satisfy the boundary conditions, so when I add them up, they still do. They satisfy the PDE, so when I add them up, they still do, because it's a linear PDE. And maybe if I add them up and I can make the initial condition hold. And that's the mind-blowing thing where Fourier series were invented. I'm going to add these up and make the initial conditions hold, and then show dear old dad that it works. Johan couldn't convince dear old dad, but it does work. And it's beautiful stuff. So the big idea is to add these up. Add them up. And back in the days of Bernoulli and Euler, you could do whatever you wanted. And you didn't get in trouble for it. So you don't have to worry about that converge, just do it. And we're going to worry about showing things converge later in this course. Today we're not going to worry about showing anything converges. Add up solutions to get more solutions. To get more The PDE is automatically satisfied when you add them up because it's a linear PDE. So the superposition principle holds. You can add solutions and get more solutions. The boundary conditions are zero. So when you add up things that are zero, they're still zero. So those are called homogeneous boundary conditions. So the boundary conditions are homogeneous, which means they're zero, and you can add them up and they stay zero. So all that stuff automatically continues to hold. And so the last problem is to worry about the initial conditions. So we've got a u of xt now, which is going to be a sum. And what the heck, Bernoulli was daring. Let's take a sum, infinite sum. Let's see, I've got a n cosine nt plus b n sine nt times sine nx. That was my x of x solution. So I put x of x last and the t of t first. Let's stick in the time equals zero. The last thing to worry about is the initial condition. So finally, I need to worry about the initial condition. So let's see, I'll stick in a u at time zero. No, time zero. U of x at time zero. All that sine junk is zero at zero. So it would be the sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, an cosine nt, when I stick in time equals zero, cosine n times zero is 1. So I get summation an sine nx, and I want that to be equal to my pluck shape. And there's the moment in history when somebody said, oh my gosh, is it really possible for me to add up sine functions that wiggle like crazy? The bigger the n is, the more this wiggles. It just wiggles like crazy. I want to add up wiggling sine functions and make them be that pluck shape, which is straight line, straight line. How in the heck is that possible? And it is possible, and Bernoulli figured out what the ans have to be, and it's fascinating. And I'll continue with this discussion next time. Just to get ready for next time, if I calculate this derivative, let's see, du by dt xt, let's see, what's that? When I differentiate with respect to time, the derivative of sine is cosine, the derivative of cosine is minus sine. So what you get is a summation n equal to 1 to infinity nbn. Sine nx. I remember we were plucking it from rest. What? We want that to equal to zero. And so we're plucking it from rest. Well, the obvious way to make this add up to zero is to take all the bn's to be equal to zero. And so my solution to the problem is going to be that very simple. So to finish off for today, the solution that Bernoulli found is u of xt is a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, an sine nx times cosine nt. And to finish off the exciting work, the problem is going to be to make that initial condition hold, to make that thing add up to f of x. And that's going to determine the a's, and I'm going to show you next time using Maple that it really does converge. If Johann had had Maple, he could have maybe convinced dear old dad that this was a correct solution. Okay, that's enough for today. Thank you.
Yeah. How many chapters are you going to cover?
Oh, I'm not 100% sure. I want to get to the Fourier integral.
Oh, okay.